Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello and welcome to Valley Public Radio's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, with California's economy on the mend, we'll learn five ways to get a job in the new normal that is today's job market. We'll also talk to a man who, as a child, was homeless, spent time as a monk in Spain, and now is a passionate advocate for his adopted hometown, the city of Fresno's first poet laureate. We'll also take a crack at what should be a big event this weekend in Bakersfield, the first ever Kern County Nut Festival. That and more later in this hour. But first, our series on ice cream in the San Joaquin Valley, which we call Summer Scoop, takes a trip along Highway 99 to Tulare and Bakersfield, where two plants, one of them the largest ice cream factory in the world, churn out dairy delights for much of the country. It's ice cream on a massive scale, with Häagen-Dazs and dryers. How do they do it? And why is the Central Valley king when it comes to ice cream? Valley Public Radio's Ezra Romero reports.
Clifford Fung eats a lot of ice cream. 3 to 5 times a day, Fung and his crew of ice cream tasters chop, taste, and decide if the Häagen-Dazs ice cream made in Tulare, California is 1, palatable, and 2, worthy of your freezer and belly.
We're making sure that we're delivering the best product to our consumer. We analyze it, taste it, we look at it visually, so when the consumers receive it, they expect the best when they see our product.
Fung works at the smaller of Nestle's 2 ice cream factories in the region. It's second only to the Dreyer's ice cream facility in Bakersfield, which the company claims is the largest ice cream plant in the world. Tim Keating is a Bakersfield plant manager.
We produce all of the Nestle products that are sold within the U.S. with the exception of Häagen-Dazs, which is produced up the street in Tulare.
Last year, ice cream production in California topped 131 million gallons, which leads the nation. And making that much ice cream takes a lot of milk. Nestle's Bakersfield and Tulare plants alone use just under 1 billion gallons of dairy products each year.
Dairy products is still a really, really big part of our industry.
That was Tricia Blattler, the executive director of the Tulare County Farm Bureau. The sheer amount of Valley milk and cream used in Nestle's ice cream is vital for the Valley dairy industry.
Our dairy industry is the largest concentrated region of dairy production in the United States and possibly across the entire globe. And all of the dairy products that we produce here are produced on a scale that's almost implausible to other regions in the nation.
Nestle in Kern County employs 1,200 people at their Dreyer's Bakersfield plant. But the Valley wasn't always an industrial-scale ice cream mecca. Around the turn of the century, Bill Dreyer immigrated to America from Germany and started an ice cream business in Oakland. Dreyer's also came up with the original flavor Rocky Road after the stock market crash in 1929 to make people smile during rocky times. In 1988, Dreyer's opened its plant in Bakersfield thanks to the San Joaquin Valley's strong agricultural economy. In 2005, they expanded the facility, eventually shifting production to the Valley from older plants in Commerce and Union City.
The reason that we're located here in Bakersfield, number one, is we're closest to the raw materials. We're close to the dairy source primarily, but we're also close to some of the other agricultural products that we include in our ice cream, such as nuts.
Today, the 600,000-square-foot Bakersfield facility accounts for 33% of Nestle's domestic ice cream production. Just like Dreyer's, the minds behind Häagen-Dazs saw Central California as a best-kept secret for ice cream production. In the case of Häagen-Dazs, the decision to locate a factory in Tulare in the 1980s was initially met with skepticism from the company's founder, Ruben Mattis. But according to Macy Deremy, new products manager at the Häagen-Dazs plant in Tulare,
they flew him out here. He kind of saw the area, and he thought Tulare would be a great place to make this Häagen-Dazs ice cream, ultimately because this is where the cows are.
The company with a funny name started in the Bronx, New York in the 1960s. And like Dreyer's, it too was eventually purchased by Nestle. Today, these two leaders produce ice cream products that line grocery freezers across the nation. But Tim Keating from the Bakersfield plant says most consumers have no idea that their drumstick or skinny cow ice cream sandwich likely came from the valley.
I don't think people really understand not only the volume of ice cream that we're producing here, that actually the world's largest ice cream factory is in Bakersfield. We recently put a billboard sign up on the 99 to try to get some awareness there. But with the oil industry here in Bakersfield, that's really the top industry, so we don't get as much play in terms of awareness.
Deremy and Tulare says that Häagen-Dazs has planted itself in Tulare County for a reason. It's all about taste.
We have a lot of larger scale dairies here that we can provide milk to the factory. So we have a constant supply, a constant flow of milk coming in from these dairymen. And the flavor of that milk is always very consistent because the herds eat very similar nutrients for their diets. Because as we know that the milk that a cow produces, the taste is really determined by what they eat.
But whether or not consumers know exactly where their ice cream comes from, when it comes to the clink of spoon to bowl this summer, there will likely be a little bit of Central California making people smile all across the nation. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero. You can see photos and more from our interactive series Summer Scoop on our website, kvpr.org. We have our ice cream tweet up from last week where you can see tweets and other mentions from folks on social media and photos from the event online. Also, share your favorite ice cream memories, recipes, and treasured destinations. Our email address is talk@kvpr.org. They just may wind up in one of our future Summer Scoop reports. And be sure to tag your ice cream-related Instagram photos and tweets with hashtag Scoop89. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Right now at a warehouse in southeast Fresno, county elections workers are busy verifying signatures on the last handful of provisional ballots that will decide the fate of Measure G, the controversial trash outsourcing initiative. As of the most recent vote count released last Friday, the measure is currently failing by just 193 votes, with around 2,700 ballots left to count. It's a scene that recalls the 2000 presidential election in Florida, complete with observers from both sides and threats of legal action over process and procedure. We asked Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins to help us make sense of the situation. Jeff, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Do we have any recent parallels for something like this where you have observers looking at each signature, objecting to some, talk of court filings? Is there anything even remotely similar in recent memory?
Well, I can't think of anything locally where we've come down to a few hundred votes. The thing to remember about these types of really close elections is that they're a lot more likely in lower-level races, city council. So if you look at the number of people who are voting in some of the outlying communities in the Valley area, it comes down to a few hundred votes, maybe 10, 20 votes. Of course, this is the city of Fresno, a major city in the country. And so it's surprising and happens very rarely that it comes down to a few hundred votes and you have perhaps some court challenges taking place on verification of signatures of voters and so on.
The last time an outsourcing issue went before voters in Fresno County was last November with Measure O in Fresno County. Tell us about that and maybe how – are there any insights we can gain between these two?
Well, it's interesting from the perspective that it's so similar in terms of the topic and how close the outcome was. The no on Measure O side won by a little less than 2%, I think. But that measure would have made it easier for the Fresno County Board of Supervisors to outsource county services. Looking back, of course, it's kind of a precursor to what we're seeing here in terms of the very close battle lines that are drawn over outsourcing and privatization and both sides' ability. In particular, I think, the ability of the union-supported side to turn their voters out.
Now, with the count that's currently ongoing, the No on G side is currently in the lead by a little less than a couple hundred votes. We expect an updated tally on Wednesday. Looking at the various scenarios that are out there, how, if this breaks one way or the other, would this impact the political future of Mayor Swearengin, both here in Fresno and also any further political ambitions that she may have in the future as she's termed out when this current term expires?
Sure.
If it goes Swearengin's way, yes on G, or if it goes the other way?
It's certainly a blow to her public standing. As any politician would like to go undefeated on all the issues, it never happens, even for the most successful politicians. So I don't think this one issue is going to, you know, sink her administration or sink her political future. And in terms of just locally her ability to get things done, I don't think it's going to change too much. It really comes down to what vote she can get on the council. It's unlikely to change her four-vote majority that she seems to have on the council. She still has veto authority. I don't think it changes her ability to negotiate contracts with the other labor unions. Depending on how this plays out, if she loses the Measure G, it could actually strengthen her position with the police officers union, because she could say that we don't have much to offer now because we don't have the flexibility that Measure G was going to offer us in terms of being able to negotiate with the police union. So she might be in a little bit stronger position when it comes to negotiating the police union contract.
Swearengin's name has been mentioned by a number of people in Sacramento also as being a Republican who might have potential for statewide office or serving in Sacramento in some way. I'm not sure if she's been out there putting her name out, but others have. What would Measure G's failure or its success do to her political future beyond Fresno?
I don't think Measure G will have much impact on her ability to run for statewide office. If anything, I would say just the position that she's taking of outsourcing from the very beginning, even if we don't get to Measure G or not, is what is going to be most influential. And the reason I say that is it's very hard for any Republican candidate to gain much traction in a statewide race now. And we see that just with the fact that all of our statewide offices are held by Democrats. So it's going to be hard for any Republican. And if a Republican is going to be competitive in a statewide election, they're going to have to be moderate, if not, you know, tilting to the left. So that's why I say just the fact that she's already staked out her position on outsourcing and privatization could potentially hurt her in a statewide matchup.
You mentioned that if Measure G fails in the final count, that in some way it could actually strengthen Swearengin's hand at the negotiating table with the Fresno Police Officers Association. Could it also be possible that if Measure G fails and things at City Hall continue to operate, the fiscal emergency issue is out there? Swearengin has talked about the possibility of declaring a fiscal emergency. Has she boxed herself into a corner in some way if Measure G fails, that she's going to have to do that? Or does it give her more freedom in saying, you know what, things have improved, but this is still an issue that's a concern and we need to rein in the costs of the employment at City Hall?
Well, I think a couple of things. First, I don't think it boxes her in. In any political environment, the circumstances change, information changes, revenue estimates for the city and state are going to change. And my guess is that the revenue situation is going to improve, and so the city will be in better circumstances. But aside from that, now that you don't have one of your main proposals to ease the city's finances, you have a pretty solid reason for why you're going to make additional cuts, for why going into the negotiations with the police officers union that you have to be much tighter in terms of flexibility. So in some ways, whereas I'm sure that she preferred, her administration preferred that Measure G passes, in other ways it kind of makes some of these other things easier for her to have to deal with.
Two more quick questions. One final one about Measure G. It's very rare in Fresno history to see an issue like this come before voters with a successful petition drive, and then the election. The council could have decided not to hold the special election and simply reversed its decision. Do you see a possibility that we might see more petition drives that would overturn such controversial votes in the future?
I would say from just the city council's perspective, I think they're going to give more consideration to their votes, thinking that a referendum is a possibility. I'm not sure that it's going to make that much difference. I mean, I think it's an issue by issue concern, I guess you would say, because on other issues that the council and the mayor decide on, you're probably not going to get the union backing or the support that we saw in this. It was just this particular issue happened to strike a chord with city voters.
Before we go, Senate District 16, that election is coming up next month. We thought for a while that Andy Vidak had won it outright with over 50% of the vote, but as the final votes were counted, it's a runoff between Leticia Perez, the Kern County supervisor, and the Kings County farmer. What's your analysis of that race moving forward? It's a district that leans Democrat. Does Perez have smooth sailing moving forward, or is Vidak the rising star that many in the Republican Party would like to see him as?
I still think it's Vidak's to lose, and you have to go back to the registration advantage that Democrats have in the district. It's right around 20%, and the fact that Vidak did so well in an overwhelmingly Democratic district, I would say that it's his to lose. Now, of course, when you add up the Democratic votes, there are two other Democratic candidates in the race, that it makes it a very competitive race. But I guess my gut instinct would say that given Vidak's competitiveness a few years ago when he ran against Jim Costa in a congressional race, and the fact that Leticia Perez is somewhat new on the political scene, I would probably have to bet the odds on Andy Vidak in that race.
Would you expect to see some big sources of outside money coming in for this race, given the fact that the primary was closer than many people expected?
Well, I think it's definitely going to be a high-profile race, and that's because the Democrats and the state Senate are sitting on this two-thirds majority. They're right about a one- or two-vote margin. There's some other special elections going on in the state that could decrease or pretty much maintain the status quo there. So we're going to see a lot of money from all over the state coming into the race, and it's because that two-thirds vote majority in the Senate is so crucial to getting stuff done in Sacramento.
Our guest today has been Jeff Cummins, political science professor at Fresno State, talking about the fate of Measure G as we wait with bated breath to find out the final tally, hopefully on Wednesday, and about Senate District 16, the runoff election happening next month between Leticia Perez and Andy Vidak. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. That special election we just mentioned in Senate District 16 is certain to produce at least one debate between the candidates as they talk about issues facing the Valley. But political commentator Joe Matthews of our media partner Zocalo Public Square says that California voters should scrap the tired system of debates where candidates rarely stray from their talking points and go with something a little more insightful.
When was the last time you heard a California political debate that convinced you of anything? The exercise is merely an exchange of tired sound bites and attacks that tell us very little about the candidates. Here's the good news. California has many non-political contests that would reveal the knowledge, character, and judgment of candidates. We simply need to apply them to the political process. Here are five we should use in place of debates. The first is the academic contest. Too many candidates dodge detailed questions, but it's hard to dodge a written exam. My favorite is the 50-question quiz given to prospective contestants on the game show Jeopardy, which is filmed in Culver City. If candidates balk, they could take something easier, the California High School Exit Exam. Politicians require it of students, after all, so why not require it of politicians? Second would be the job interview contest. Politicians love to talk about jobs, but how many of them could get a job at, say, Google? Here's a genuine job interview question they ask there. You are shrunk to the height of a nickel, and your mass is proportionally reduced so as to maintain your original density. You are then thrown into an empty glass blender. The blades will start moving in 60 seconds. What do you do? Come up with a smart answer for that, and you've got my vote. Third is the social cohesion contest. A California leader must bring together diverse peoples. What better test than the Great Garlic Cook-Off at the Midsummer Garlic Festival in Gilroy? Just as a fine politician makes new coalitions and unifies them in service of a greater goal, a successful dish combines familiar foods in new ways in the service of greater enjoyment, or in Gilroy, in the service of garlic. Candidates must also make a meal of what they cook and wash it down with garlic milkshakes. After all, politicians too rarely eat what they serve up for the rest of us. Fourth would be the building contest. California's aging infrastructure has nearly $800 billion in projected needs over the next 10 years. The appropriate infrastructure test of candidates would be for each to lead the construction of a Rose Parade float. Candidates could spend no more than $300,000, and they must honor the Rose Parade's maze of regulations, which mimic the complexity of state law and local building codes. After that, dealing with the California Environmental Quality Act is a piece of cake. Fifth and finally, the herding contest. Any leader knows that bringing groups into alignment is like leading a bunch of mules. Fortunately, one of California's great public events, Mule Days in the town of Bishop, includes an event called the Packers Scramble, in which mules are unloaded and untethered from their teams. And then cowboys scatter them around an arena. The winning packer is the first to reassemble his or her team of mules in the chaos and lead them out of the arena. Once you see the Packers scramble, you'll agree with me. We should cancel next year's election and simply appoint the winner governor.
That was Joe Matthews with Zocalo Public Square with that California-connected commentary. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with a man who says Fresno saved his life and is now on a mission to share his poetry and his love for his adopted hometown with the rest of the nation. And five tips to get a job in the new normal in California. We'll talk with Michael Burnick and get his insights on the best way to get and keep a job. That's coming up next on Valley Edition. Stay close.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. I'm Joe Moore. A few weeks ago, the readers of the New York Times saw a major feature about Fresno. But it wasn't about the city's poor air quality, the high poverty rate, or struggling economy. Instead, it was about James Tyner, the city's first official poet laureate. He's since been featured on NPR and other major media outlets. Tyner has good company locally. He joins former U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine, also a Fresno resident, and current California Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera, who taught for many years at Fresno State. James Tyner joins us today on Valley Edition to talk about his amazing life story and this latest honor, plus his love for his hometown. James Tyner, welcome to Valley Public Radio.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me today.
How has your life changed in the past 2 months since this announcement that you are the city's first poet laureate? Fresno has a great tradition of poetry going back to Phil Levine and Peter Everwine and many others, Larry Levis and company. But you're the first one to have this title for the city of Fresno. Mm-hmm. What's that been like? You've been getting a lot of attention from both in the local community and from beyond.
It's true. A very, very, very simple answer. My life has changed, becoming so much busier. It's been long days, long weeks, but at the same time, I absolutely love it. I'm so honored, absolutely honored. Like you mentioned, we just come from such a rich, long, huge tradition of poets. I mean, because of that, I was very surprised when they chose me. I'm still an up-and-coming poet. I'm still new. I'm not as well-published or as well-known. At the same time, I'm extremely honored and working really hard to get out there. And yeah, the exposure has been wild.
You were talking about yourself and your work a moment ago. You said you're an up-and-coming poet. You are just getting started. Do you see some parallels between what you just said about yourself maybe and the city itself and the people who live here?
You know, that's an awesome point. And that's true. I'm not an unpublished poet. I have about 25 poems published in various academic journals. I'm in three anthologies. I have an award-winning chapbook. And then on top of that, even more so, I do a lot of community work. I've been doing workshops for the public for free through the library. Been doing readings, getting poets from Fresno State, getting poets from around all over to come in and read to the public and, you know, let Fresno be exposed to this richness that we have here in terms of the literature and the poetry. But yeah, you do. It's a great parallel. The city, I even put in one of my poems, the city's finally recognizing itself. It's starting to see itself in terms of this, the writing and the literature. And for me, it's kind of the same way. For years, I struggled. I never even considered myself a poet, even though I've been writing now for some time. Even while I was getting published, I still didn't truly consider myself a poet. And until just recently, it's like, okay, maybe I am a poet after all these publications. And maybe it's the same way for the city in a way. This parallels is just starting to recognize itself and what it can do and just some of the greatness there.
Is there a job description for a poet laureate? Do you find out this is what we're supposed to do as poets laureate of a city? Have you talked to others in similar positions? Obviously, we have the poet laureate of the United States, Philip Levine, here in our midst in Fresno. But what do you do as a poet laureate?
It's interesting. There was a gentleman by the name of Mike Medrano. He is the one who got the ball rolling on the whole concept of the Poet Laureate of Fresno. And he sent out emails to a bunch of us. And we all kind of met one day and we talked about it and started to hammer it out. And I actually worked on it. My job was to go around and looking at other places in the nation, other cities that had a Poet Laureate and what they required, what they asked. Generally, it's making a few appearances a year. But yeah, we looked at Santa Barbara, we looked at Vancouver, all these places to see what they required. It's something, I hate to say this because it sounds so strange, but there's that sense of civic pride, you know, loving the city and just showing that small example, you know, representing your city, but also through the work and revealing kind of that inner nature of the city.
Why do you think it is that Fresno has such a rich tradition of poets? Is it just the fact that Phil Levine came here in the 1950s and started a poetry program at Fresno State? And it's grown since then? Or is there something else going on?
Yeah, I mean, well, first let me answer that. There was always a joke among poets, like as we're going up, that everybody in the world knows about Fresno poets except for Fresno. I was living in the mountains of Spain as a monk, and here I'm in the middle of nowhere. And I mean, no one around for miles. And someone, one of the monks went out and he brought back some papers, newspapers, and he happened to bring me an L.A. Times. And I wasn't into poetry at the time, so I opened up this L.A. Times. So happy to see my mother tongue, and, you know, it's about L.A., where I was originally born. And then I'm flipping through, and there's this article in Fresno Poets. This is about 95-ish. And I was just so stunned. I wasn't into poetry, but, like, here is my hometown now, Fresno, and then this poetry movement. And so there was a line in there. They asked one of the poets, why do you think all these poets are coming out of here? And she said, I don't know, but I think it has something to do with the dust. And in a sense, I think she's right. And I think further than that, also, there's this work ethic. It comes from a little bit from Philip Levine, this working class poets, but also more than just being working class, a work ethic. You know, we have the fields out here. We have the dairies, and there's this real sense of work. We all work, and we bring those sensibilities and that ethic to our poetry. And I think that that's really what drives us and links us shoulder to shoulder as Fresno poets.
I would be remiss if I didn't follow up on that last answer. When you were living in the mountains of Spain as a monk, how did you come to poetry as a career? And tell me a little more about your background. That sounds very interesting.
Yeah, I was out of high school. No one in my family went to college, so I had no idea what to do, and I was kind of languishing. And a cousin of mine said, hey, I know this school you can get into. It's free. Just come on down to L.A. So I believed him. I went there, and he dropped me off at a monastery. I was not religious by any means. It was a culture shock for me and for the poor monks. Basically, he was dating a girl at the time, and the girl's mother was getting the studying monks into the local city college, and so felt like they owed her a favor, I guess. So he got me in there, and it was a good life. I love the hard work. I love being with people. It gave me a little time to, you know, be contemplative and to research and learn another language. But I got into poetry years later. I mean, maybe that finding that paper was the seed germinating, but years later, I was decided to be a novelist or an English teacher. That was going to be my thing. I was going to write horror novels, be an English teacher. And I went to take a fiction class. It was filled, and the only thing that worked was a poetry class. So I thought, nah, it's not my thing, but let me try it. And very first poem is Connie Hale. She read a poem to introduce us, a poet by the name of Dorian Locks, teaches out of Oregon now. And the poem is called Two Portraits of My Sister. And it's the first stanza is the speaker's looking at this picture of her sister. And the second stanza is a memory. And in the memory, the sister gets abused by the father, gets hit with a belt buckle on the face. And there's a line about the bruise blossoming like a flower. And I had never experienced anything like that, to be moved, these powerful images, and to realize that poetry was more than just, you know, this fruity lines on paper. It was real movement, real power, real change. And that was it. I was done. And I kept coming back to it and researching, reading more and more and more. And I knew that I had this had to be a part of my life.
James Tyner joins us here on Valley Public Radio today. He is the poet laureate of the city of Fresno. What do you hope to accomplish as a poet, as a poet laureate?
As a poet, I guess sometimes I've lived a unique life. So my goal, oddly enough, was to share it. It was to tell the stories of my family, what we lived through. I am what you would call biracial, bicultural. My mother's Mexican, my father's not. And there's a lot of rich stories there. And I grew up all on the Chicano side, the Mexican side. And to share those stories and to tell those things and to give people a voice. It sounds weird voicing that, but honestly, that's what's in my heart and that's why I do it. As poet laureate, my main goal, to put it in one sentence, is simply to let Fresno be aware of what they have here and its rich culture. On a side note, I've noticed that a lot of poet laureates focus on a project, and I'm working on some ideas. They usually, you know, anything from poetry on buses to poetry in the airport, or Juan Felipe Herrera in particular, and he's kind of being my – he's the poet laureate of California. My guide in this is he did an anti-bullying campaign with poetry, very powerful stuff. And that's kind of what I'm leaning towards. I'm in talks with an organization out of LA. They work with multi-ethnic, biracial, bicultural children and families. And being one, I feel like that might be my goal as poet laureate, is to do some sort of awareness campaign. I'm still working on titles and what I can and can't do in terms of poetry. And because Fresno here was so diverse, we're so multi-ethnic, there's so many cultures here, and there's so many children like myself. I was at a family barbecue the other day, and my little cousin is half African-American and half Mexican. And my wife is just like myself, and then we have a half one of my other cousins is half Lao and, again, half Chicano. And just to have this huge range of flavors in there, and I just really – I think that might be my goal, spoiler. How I'm going to do it yet, I'm still working out the details. But
you wrote a poem for the occasion of being poet laureate, being named to this position, I Am Fresno. Could you tell us about that and then maybe read some from that?
Yeah, absolutely. When I found out, they emailed me and said, you know, we're going to choose you. Would you accept? And I said yes. I was overwhelmed, but I kept thinking, I got to do something in honor of the moment, in honor of Fresno. I wanted to do something that anybody who is not a poet that is from Fresno that would read this would be like, hey, I recognize that, or, you know, that's me, or that's my family member, or I can see that. And so I started writing it. I wasn't very happy with it, so I sent it to a great friend of mine, excellent poet by the name of Michelle Britton. She has a wonderful eye with my work, so she looked at it and was poking at it. And then I thought, okay, you know, I'll let this sit. I probably won't need it right away. And then the mayor's assistant sends me an email the morning before they were going to make the public announcement in the media. And he says, hey, by the way, do you have a poem? So I was like, oh, no. So that morning I cleaned it up. I took Michelle's advice. I fixed it up that morning, spelling errors in there and everything. And I went out there and I read the piece. More than myself, I really wanted to do it for Fresno. I wanted to make people who aren't poets to be able to read it, to be accessible to them, and to enjoy it and identify with it. So I worked really hard at it. It's called I Am Fresno. I'll go ahead and read it here. The title is Fresno 2013. I am Fresno. I am the high school kid that can't wait to get out of this town. There's nothing to do here. Nothing ever happens. Waiting for that last summer before heading out of the city. I'm the kid just back from college, moving back in with mom and dad, trying to find a job now that school's over. Back home again, taking down old posters from the wall and putting up diplomas. I am the couple that just bought their first house, a fixer-upper, yard golden from too much sun. Their three-year-old walking up the steps, paint still on dad's pants from the bedroom he just finished. I am fields of vines, grapes growing in a vast green, raisins drying on brown paper, strawberries just plucked from the field. I am moving north, new buildings, restaurants, glass and plastic, meeting not so far from the river, a hail of lights and traffic. I am coming back downtown, dusting off the concrete and brick, old restaurants that have been there for years, fresh again. I am new businesses sprouting, and food trucks turning up like flowers over asphalt. I'm a softball player, mitt clenched tightly, a wrestler alone on a mat, a stadium of waving red, I am a long line of poets, words spreading through culture, through time, through classrooms, through books. I am the owner of championships, of Pulitzers, Oscars, Tonys, struggling to win just one more thing. I am noticing myself. Finally, I am at a family barbecue and all the children there share the same last name, the same blood, and all have different shades of skin. My father by the pool, speaking Spanish to my daughter, his aged brown hand running through her wispy blonde hair. I am a bowl of pho for breakfast, the noodles warm, broth like a hug, meat tender and fresh. I am lulu kebabs for lunch, the spice just behind the tongue, pilaf golden and perfect. I am sitting at the dinner table, rolling a hot dog into a corn tortilla, boiled beans and white rice, the air growing smoky from the tri-tip barbecuing outside. My cousin bringing in a plate of pan-fried noodles from the place down the street. I am home. I am Fresno.
Poet James Tyner joining us on Valley Edition today, reading from his poem Fresno 2013, I Am Fresno. He was named the Poet Laureate of the city just about 2 months ago, and since then he's received considerable national attention, a write-up in the New York Times, a feature on Boston's NPR station WBUR. What's it been like receiving the national attention, and maybe not so much the national attention personally, but being the ambassador for Central California, for Fresno, to a national audience in some way in what is obviously a positive light? This is a chance for Fresno to receive attention for something other than something bad.
That's right. And it's that right there that makes me, one, at the same time, so overwhelmed and yet so honored. So when they offered me this, I sat down for a moment and I thought, I'm a quiet guy, but for these 2 years, it's not going to be like that. And am I willing to do this? And I thought, I love poetry. I can't stop thinking about it. I look at a tree, I look at a shade, I look at my children, and lines come to my head. And I love the city. I'm not afraid to tell people that the city saved me. When I was a kid, we were homeless for a little bit. We were jumping around living with different family members in LA, and my mom decided we're coming to Fresno. That's where she was from. Brought us here, and the city saved me. We were able to get our own house, first time I ever lived in a house. And, you know, I feel like I growing up in a Mexican family and in poor neighborhoods, there was gangs everywhere, a lot of rough stuff. And I feel that things like literature saved me. I was an avid reader. And then the city itself, you know, provided programs and things like that for us that really got me out of the streets and I think saved me. And so to be able to give back to the city is such a complete honor. Like I said, I'm no one special, just someone who absolutely loves this and loves Fresno and loves the chance for people to be, one, for Fresno people to be proud of it, and then for the entire nation for once to be like, wow, look at that. That is awesome. Let's model ourselves after this town.
James Tyner, our guest today on Valley Public Radio's Valley Edition. He was named about 2 months ago to the post of Poet Laureate of the City of Fresno. Over the next 2 years, he will speak to local audiences and national ones as well, sharing his poetry and spreading the word about Fresno. James Tyner joins us today on Valley Edition. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's an absolute honor. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. It's been over 5 years since the start of the Great Recession. In that time, California lost over 1 million jobs, with the San Joaquin Valley taking an especially hard hit. While the state's economy continues to recover, many economists and labor analysts say the job market has changed permanently, something they call the new normal. Joining us now to talk about what this means is Michael Burnick. He is the former director of the California Employment Development Department, is counsel with the Sedgwick Law Firm in San Francisco, and a research fellow with the Milken Institute. His essay on the new normal recently appeared on the website of our media partner, Zocalo Public Square. Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
When you talk about the new normal, you single out three trends that are defining the job market in a new way. What are those?
Well, let me first say I've been in the job training world. I started in 1979, so I've been involved for some time. And throughout that whole time, there's been ups and downs in the unemployment rates and the job numbers and the natural evolution of jobs. But what's occurring now is not just cyclical change in the Californian. In impact in the American economy, but I would say certain structural changes, thus the new normal. And among those changes, I would say there are three. One is intense competition for almost any job. A second one is the full-time employment replaced by part-time employment, contingent employment, and independent contracting. In other words, by alternative work arrangements. And the third is the greater and greater cost competition and pressure to reduce wages. These aren't the only structural changes, but they're part of the new normal.
Is it unusual or perhaps typical that we would see these major changes happen after a major economic downturn? Isn't that something we have seen in the past as well?
Well, the Great Recession hastened the arrival of this new normal, but the economic and social forces driving the new normal really predate 2007. And that's why I say it really reflects structural, not just cyclical changes. I've been through three or four recessions since I've been in the job train world. In the early 80s in California, when we had that significant manufacturing loss, in particular in the 90s, and the early 2000s with our dot-com bust. So we've had a lot of ups and downs. We've had previous recessions. What's different now are certain structural changes, again, accelerated by the Great Recession of 2008-2009, but really reflecting other forces.
When you say structural changes, not to get too into the world of policy wonks here, but what exactly do you mean there?
Well, we've always had changes in the unemployment rate. We've had downturns. Now the job world is changing in certain fundamental ways. One is this breakdown in full-time employment that at least offered the opportunity for stability. In the post-World War II period in California, in the 50s and 60s, and even up through much of the 70s, the model, the prevalent model of employment was of full-time employer-employee relation. Didn't include everyone. There are a lot of people on the margins, even in the 50s and 60s. But the idea of stable employment with a single employer for some length of time was the prevalent model. That's been breaking down. It's been breaking down for several reasons. Most of all, globalization, but also the impacts of technology and the speed of technology, the culture of work and the ties between employers and employees, and the breakdown and decline of private sector unions. So there are a number of forces. But the result has been this breakdown in stable employment, employer-employee relation into other forms of contingent employment, part-time employment, and, as I say, independent contracting.
So with this new normal, what should workers do? And I know you have some specific tips. We'll talk about those in a moment. But before we get to that, are we doing the necessary things as a state in our world of education and public policy and employment and economic development? Are we doing the right things to adapt to this new reality? Because what you're suggesting is this is permanent. This is the new normal. It's not an aberration. Have we done the right things in preparing for this new reality as a whole before we talk about the specifics?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The job training system in California, it's been under attack as long as I've been involved since the late 70s. It continues to be. But in fact, we have a pretty good system here, a very good system in some ways. It's focused on the local workforce investment boards. You have several in the Valley that are very good. They focus on taking unemployed people and training them for or placing them into jobs. They're highly aimed and tied to the local labor market. They understand the local labor market. So it's not as if we have, as is often portrayed, a job train system that, quote, doesn't train people for jobs or is behind the times. That isn't true at all. In fact, the training in most every part of California is well tied to jobs, developed in close connection with employers, and really geared toward job placement. The big obstacle, the limitation in training, is on the demand side. It's the lack of jobs. it's not as if I think our training system can be improved in terms of other partners in the training system, particularly the community colleges, but we have a good foundation, a good fundamentals, good bones in terms of a job training system here. Again, the limitation is in terms of the demand side and the number of jobs.
When it comes to the skills, though, necessary in this competitive market, not just to be qualified, but to stand out in this large pool of applicants, you point to some specific things that people maybe who haven't searched for a job in, let's say, 10 years or so, the world has changed in a way when you're applying for jobs or trying to make contacts and things. Tell us about some of your tips for people.
I think the key element that's changed since the 70s and 80s and even the 90s is, of course, the competition. It's how much greater the competition is than in these previous decades. Still, there is a lot of hiring that goes on, and there are opportunities. A couple key elements I would recommend and do recommend is, first, getting in the door. It often is the case one can't get in through perhaps a full-time job but can get in through part-time work or project work or independent contracting work, or even volunteering. All of those are good elements to get in the door. The most important thing today, I believe, is getting in the door, showing what you can do, and then moving around. A second point involves the job boards. When I first went to a job, looked for a job at EDD in 1970, jobs were posted on 3x5 cards on cork boards. Now, of course, the system has evolved in several iterations over the years, and particularly now with the internet job boards, have come to dominate. The internet job boards are good. They're a starting point, but employers are hopelessly inundated with applications. And in most cases, putting a resume through a job board has no value. In fact, I think the estimates are about 4% of people find jobs through any contact with the job boards. Still, it's a starting point. I think one wants to build on that in terms of recommendations from people in the firm, because employers are so inundated today, getting a recommendation from someone within the firm is very important. I think it's also important to try to look at other ways of going beyond putting in a resume to, say, preparing a white paper on sales techniques or a video or something else to show the passion and skill one can bring to the job. So the job boards are a start. One needs to build on those and take a couple of additional techniques. And also, finally, I'd say the networks. The job network has always been a key element in terms of job search in California and elsewhere. It's even more important now. Both traditional networks, that's family, friends, acquaintances, and also I think these networks through some of the, obviously LinkedIn is the dominant online network now, but I think these online networks are also worth pursuing.
And you have one other bit of advice in your column that ran on the website Zocalo Public Square, and that's no whining. Tell us about that.
Well, it's one of the untold stories of, I think, the Great Recession, and continuing the case that most California job seekers will submit stacks of resumes without getting any response. They're going on interviews that turn out to be charades, and yet they wake up each morning and start again. The resilience of our labor force in California is, as I say, one of the untold stories. And when I volunteer with job seekers, we go through how things have changed. We go through how brutal it is out there. We go through the new normal. But then I say, you know, let's move on. No whining. We need to look for a job.
Before we go, one last question. I've heard this phrase, the new normal, applied not only to what you're talking about here, but also to our unemployment rate overall. And there are some economists who have suggested that the standard unemployment that we normally see or consider full employment across the nation, that we might in the future just see a permanent 1 or 2 percentage points added to that unemployment rate moving forward. Do you see that a permanently higher unemployment rate is also part of a new normal in the job market?
I think there are 2 points to make about it. One, there was a time not too long ago when 4% was considered to be the normal unemployment rate. I would agree that now we're up looking at 6% or slightly above. But I think the main point is the unemployment rate less and less reflects what's really going on in the job world. First, it includes part-time workers. We have about 1 million part-time workers, or 1 million workers who are working part-time in California who prefer full-time work but can't find it. Some of these are working only 10 or 15 hours a week, and yet they're considered to be employed for the unemployment rate and for the payroll numbers. We have people working as independent contractors who may have viable businesses but may just have, you know, one or two projects and are barely hanging on, if at all. Yet they're considered employed for the unemployment rate. The unemployment rate less and less reflects what's going on, in part because of this breakdown of the employer-employer relationship into other parts of, as I say, part-time, contingent, and independent contracting, all of which is considered to be employed for the unemployment rate, but represents a different form of work than we've seen in the past.
Well, it certainly is an interesting concept, and as the job market continues to change, the impact on our economy and those looking for work certainly is large. Our guest today has been Michael Burnick, the former director of the California Employment Development Department. He is counsel with the Sedgwick Law Firm in San Francisco and a research fellow with the Milken Institute. He wrote a piece about the new normal in terms of looking for a job in California for the website Zocalo Public Square. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay with us in just a moment. A preview of this weekend's Kern County Nut Festival is coming up next. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore. This Saturday, the grounds of the Kern County Museum will be filled with spectators, celebrity chefs, live music, and plenty of other nutty activities for the first ever Kern County Nut Festival. Joining us now on Valley Edition is Beth Pandol. She is the co-chairwoman for the festival. Beth, welcome to our program today.
Thank you for having me.
Beth, I understand this is an event that's been a couple years in the making. Planning a big festival is a huge undertaking. What's the idea behind the festival, and how did it come about?
Well, it is really a couple of years in the making. Some of us in the community had the idea a while ago that we needed a signature festival for Kern County and the Bakersfield area. And, of course, we grow 250 crops in Kern County, so we had to choose what we would focus on, and we really wanted to pattern it after things like the Gilroy Garlic Festival and the Stockton Asparagus Festival, because those are so successful and so well-known. So we kind of noodled it around and looked at all of our top crops, and when we really saw that nuts, particularly almonds and pistachios, are in our top list every year, we thought, well, those are great foods. They're nutritious and healthy. They're used in a ton of different dishes. And then it's just kind of fun to be able to play on the word nut for a festival. So we chose nuts, and we're focusing on almonds, pistachios, and walnuts. Walnuts we grow here to a lesser degree. So we want to showcase the tremendous agricultural benefits of these crops in our area, as well as the culinary aspects, which are tremendous. There's lots of great food that's going to be here.
Yeah, and the potential for puns is amazing. So
that's yes, it is. We've had to contain ourselves. We have to be very careful, too. But we're saying everybody's going to have nothing but fun. So that's our tagline this year.
Let's start with some of the culinary elements of the festival. Tell us about what's happening there. You have some celebrity chefs. You have some competitions. What can people expect?
We've had a nutty recipe contest. We opened it up to the community, and people submitted recipes. And the finalists will be judged at the festival, and they had to use at least one of the nuts in their dishes. And we had two categories of main entree and desserts. We do have an all-day, two tents going. They'll have cooking demonstrations by some wonderful chefs, some here from the Bakersfield area, but others from Napa, some that have done chefs worked in Las Vegas and some really tremendous places. So that's going to be a lot of fun, and hopefully people will learn how to use nuts in their cooking. And then we have nonprofit groups as well as local restaurants who will be serving food, and they have to have something they're serving with nuts in it. And we've got everything from almond milkshakes to meat dipped in a nut sauce, to baklava, to all kinds of things with nuts. So nobody should, they should come hungry because they won't leave hungry.
Live entertainment and things for the family to do. That's always a part of a big festival environment like this. You have all sorts of things. I was looking on your website. You have a zip line at the Kern County Museum. Tell me about that.
Well, and it's a zip line. And, you know, everybody loves zip lines these days. And actually our symphony is putting it on, which is really kind of funny. That you wouldn't really think of that, but that's the nutty part about the festival.
It's not going from the top of the clock tower, is it?
No, it's not coming down from the clock tower, but it's close to the clock tower. So that'll be a big hit. And then all kinds of other things for kids and adults. We've got an angry nuts game, like the Angry Birds game, nut toss. We've got kids can make some sun visors and put little nuts on them and decorate them, and a nutty hat contest, and a nutty water gun shootout, and a nutty marshmallow shooting game, too. It's just all kinds of crazy stuff. So everyone should have a lot of fun with that, and both kids and adults can do those things.
Live entertainment is also part of the picture for this event. Tell us about what people might hear or...
We have three stages going all day long with different bands, all kinds of different bands, country music, rock, all sorts of things. Some of the more locally known ones are Mental Borough and Lucky Ned Pepper. Those are two of our bigger ones that will be on stage, and that's going around the museum. And we are also using an adjoining park because the festival got so large. So the museum is 16 acres. We're using almost every inch of it plus the adjoining park for this. And then we have a lot of little historic buildings here on the museum grounds, and we'll be putting acoustic music on some of those porches of those little buildings. And so there's going to be nonstop musical entertainment as well. Some of the local high school bands will be here, and the Bakersfield Symphony, and then quite a number of other different types of music will be presented. So it'll be a lot of fun.
You mentioned the Gilroy Garlic Festival and the Stockton Asparagus Festival. Both of those are huge events. They've been going on for years, and they draw people from outside of the area as well. Is that something you see with this event as it grows in the future? Do you see this as being a draw to Bakersfield and Kern County?
It is absolutely our goal to make this a regional festival. This year we're focusing kind of locally because we want to just sort of get 1 year under our belt and learn something from it. But next year we really hope that we can start drawing from the Southern California area, the Central Coast, and then to the north of us into the Fresno and the Central Valley area, because people love to come to those regional festivals. We talked to the folks at Gilroy and at the Stockton Asparagus Festival and asked them how they did this, how they built this up. And we learned a lot from them. They were very helpful to us in how to put this together. And one of the things they really encouraged us to do was to involve local nonprofits and let them benefit as well. And we are. So the nonprofits who are doing booths here and so forth, they will make money at this as well as the museum. So it gets spread around the community. We think that's how we can really grow it and grow it into other areas of California.
For people who are interested in attending, what are the details? How can they get more information? And what should they do? What are the hours? Those sorts of things.
Well, the festival runs from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. on this Saturday, June 15th. I would recommend buying tickets early if you can. You can go on our website, kcnutfest.com, kcnutfest.com, and that has all the information about how to get tickets. There are tickets available online through ValleyTix. That's ValleyTix.com. But that's on our website as well. So kcnutfest.com is the best place to find out all of this. But we're going to be selling tickets at the door. Will be $2 more. So if you buy your tickets now, it's $10 for adults, $5 for children, free for children under 4. And then it's $2 more at the door. So I'd say buy early.
Well, it sounds very exciting. I think you already have one leg up on the Garlic Festival people. Pistachio ice cream sounds a lot better to me, at least, than garlic ice cream. So,
doesn't it? Oh, any ice cream is good, but with pistachio or almonds, it's really good.
Looking forward to it. That's the Kern County Nut Festival. Beth Pandel, the co-chairwoman for the event, taking place Saturday at the Kern County Museum in Bakersfield. Thanks so much for joining us today, Beth.
Thank you as well. We appreciate it.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager John Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero and company, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.